Well, good evening, everyone. Thanks for venturing out through the stormy weather and rather strange, disturbing day, too, if you've been listening to the news, which I don't usually do for first thing, but I took Michael to the train this morning, and so I listened to the news. And later I wrote a haiku about it. It's hard to fit a haiku about the news into three short lines. But since this is our week for haiku, that's what I did. This is the third week of our journey through the centuries here. And the first week we looked at Chinese Zen poetry, and last week we looked at how that classical tradition came to Japan and influenced the indigenous poetic tradition in Japan. And tonight we'll come to haiku, that most stripped down poetic form that has become known and practiced pretty much all over the world in many languages. How many of you were introduced to haiku in somewhere in school, in grade school? Yeah, look at that. I remember it from sometime in junior high school. And I don't remember the teacher telling us really much about haiku at all. It's just like, it was just write a little short poem with 575 syllables. I don't even know if she told us to put in a reference to the changing seasons. But nonetheless, I was captivated by this poetic form right away, long ago, and so I've written them off and on, sometimes regularly, sometimes not, ever since. So I thought I'd give you a few pointers on haiku. There are traditionally all these rules about how to write haiku, but they're all rules that are made to be broken. Basho, who was the kind of the great haiku poet who really launched haiku as a form, said, "Enter into the rules, then leave them behind, and you will achieve freedom for the first time." So all of these haiku rules that I'm going to tell you are useful, but not to be taken too rigidly. So the first one is the syllable count, 575, right? Haiku evolved from an older form that we talked about last week called waka, which has its roots in the earliest recorded Japanese poems and songs. Waka is what Dogen Zenji wrote in the 13th century when he wrote in Japanese. He also wrote in Chinese. And the short form of waka is called tanka, and they're used almost synonymously in the present day. And that's phrases of 57577. So from the 13th to the 16th century, it became an elegant social pastime among the educated nobility to write a series of linked verses with the pattern. One person would write a 575 verse, and then the next person would write a 77, and the next person would write a 575, and the next person would write a 77. And this was called denga, or linked verses. And the verses were, the connections, the links between the stanzas were not so much narrative as associative. You know, it might be an image or a season, different references that would be linked. Um, And then in the Edo period, that's the period of where the shoguns came into power and the capital moved from Kyoto to Tokyo, which was then Edo. This pursuit spread to the leisured samurai. It was a period of political stability. So the samurai didn't have too much fighting to do, so they took up the arts. And haiku, or it wasn't haiku yet, this linked verse became very popular, also amongst the burgeoning merchant class. So it became a kind of popular light entertainment called haikai no renga, or humorous linked verse, full of punning and wordplay. So imagine, instead of charades or Scrabble, writing poetry, a kind of good-humored competition with laughter, sake, and snacks. And that's what it would have been. But then Basho, who started out as a young man, writing and very, very involved in that world, refined haikai no renga into what later became was called haiku, and he would take the opening verse, which was called the hoku, and have that stand alone as a poem. And that's what eventually came to be called haiku. So Japanese haiku are typically written in one vertical line, without line breaks. The 5-7-5 phrases are pretty obvious to a Japanese reader or speaker, and they're natural rhythms, and they're indicated sometimes by syllables that are they're called cutting words that indicate a break in the phrase. But in English translation, it works better to use three lines. It seems to work better with English phrasing, although there are English translators who do a single line as well. And even traditional Japanese haiku poets will break the 5-7-5 rule infrequently, and usually to good effect. They don't just do it carelessly. But more and more in modern haiku, it's pretty free. In English translation, if you stick really close to the 5-7-5 rule, it can lead to some pretty stilted, silly-sounding haiku. Usually English takes fewer words. Not always, but usually fewer words. So just for fun, I thought we could look at probably the most famous haiku in Japan and the world. So if you could pass them around. Okay, so you'll see the Japanese across the top. And right underneath you'll see the Japanese reading in what are called Romaji, or Roman letters. So I'll read that. Furu ike ya kawazu tobikomu mizu no oto. Every Japanese school child can recite this. And underneath that, you'll see the literal word-for-word translation, old pond. And then ya is one of those cutting words. It serves as a pause. It sometimes almost serves as an exclamation point, but not here. Here it's more just the dash or the ellipsis, just that pause. Old pond, frog, that's kawazu. Tobikomu is a compound verb. Tobu is to fly or to jump. And then komu is to kind of go into. So combined, they become jump into, tobi komu. Mizu is water. No is indicate, it can serve as of, as an of, but it also indicates the possessive. So some people translate that water's sound. Water's sound. So I like the simplest translation, which is number one. That's how I would translate it. Old pond, frog jumps in, sound of water. And the order of the modifier is reversed there, so you have to, really it's, in English you have to say sound of water. Or you can add articles, which don't exist in Japanese, so you could say the old pond, a frog jumps in, the sound of water. You could do that. Or if you wanted to really stick to the syllable count, you'd come up with something like this. And this is by Nitobe Inazo, who, Nitobe Garden at UBC was named after. Into an old pond, a frog took a sudden plunge. Then is heard a splash. Okay, the problem with that is he's added sudden, which is not in the original. And then it's passive, then is heard. You know, so that's kind of, eh. Or if you wanted to get really carried away, you could translate it. A lonely pond in age-old stillness sleeps, apart, unstirred by sound or motion, till suddenly into it a lithe frog leaps. This is a really early one. I forget what the date of this is, but this is... Yeah. And the frog's very lithe. So that's a very early translation. Or you could try to make it rhyme. Ancient pond unstirred, into which a frog has plunged, a splash was heard. Or you could have some fun with it, like Allen Ginsberg, the old pond, a frog jumped in, kerplunk. But this is not actually one of Basho's playful haiku. He wrote some playful haiku, but this is not one. Japanese is quite rich in onomatopoeic words. So if he wanted to, he could have said pochanto or pishato. That's an onomatopoeic word for the frog jumping in. But he didn't do that. He said the sound of water. So it's definitely a more... there's a stillness to the pond that kerplunk doesn't quite kind of disrupts more than... So the examples I just gave you are from a book called 100 Frogs by Hiroaki Sato, who's a distinguished translator. And he traces the development of haiku, and in one long chapter he gives 100 different translations of this one poem. Okay, so the second haiku pointer is the kigo, which means season word. So generally, for each one of these, I'm going to say generally, because, of course, it's not always. Haiku contain a seasonal reference to nature or from human activities, which in Japan, as in most traditional societies, would have been closely linked to the natural world and the seasonal round of activities. In fact, the Japanese have entire compendiums of season words, hundreds and hundreds of them. And so they have these, I have this big, thick one in Japanese, and it's sort of, it's called in English, it's called, the closest translation would be an almanac, kind of, for a saijiki. And it's full of these season words with example haiku and photographs and interesting little facts. It's a wonderful kind of treasure trove of information. And they're usually organized by categories within each season. So there's each season, and within each season there's weather, landscape, plants, animals, human affairs, seasonal religious observances. Japan's seasons are quite distinct, more so than ours here on the rain coast, really. And each season has its particular beauty and poignancy. So the changing seasons have been used for centuries to express the Buddhist realization of impermanence. Dogen wrote a poem that became famous. This is not a haiku, it's a waka. And he called it Original Face. In spring, the cherry blossoms. In summer, the cuckoo's song. In autumn, the moon shining. In winter, the frozen snow. How pure and clear are the seasons. So those seasonal images, cherry blossoms, cuckoo's call, the autumn moon, snow, of course there are many others, but there are probably thousands of haiku written about each of them. But you don't need to go looking for a seasonal topic. The season's already here. All you have to do is let your subject come to you. Basho told his students, do not let a hair's breadth separate yourself from the subject. Speak your mind directly. Go to it without wandering thoughts. And then there's also his famous words, learn of the pine from the pine, learn of the bamboo from the bamboo. So you don't need to, it's important not to try too hard with haiku. Okay, I'm going to skip this part. So another pointer. Generally, haiku express direct contact with the world through the senses. Sights, sounds, smells, tastes, textures, right? Haiku is embodied poetry. Concrete rather than philosophical or abstract. Metaphor is more often implicit than explicit. Any symbolism emerges quite organically from the natural resonances, likenesses, and unlikenesses of the things of the world. There are so many examples of this, this characteristic of haiku, that I gave up trying to make a selection. I have not made a selection for you. I'm going to pass out haiku books, and you're going to make the selection. Okay? In a bit. Another point to haiku pointer is haiku usually contain some kind of juxtaposition, often paradoxical, of two parts that may be related by similarity or contrast or causality or simply by what the Vietnamese Zen teacher Thich Nhat Hanh calls interbeing. Being in this world, being connected in this web of existence. So this quality of haiku is what in Zen we call merging of difference and unity, identity of the relative and the absolute. But it's in haiku it's brought right down to earth, to this moment, this season, this particular place, experience through these eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind. Here's a famous Basho haiku. Shizukasa ya ima iwa ni shimi iru semi no koi. The stillness, soaking into stones, cicadas cry. If you've ever been in Japan in the summer, you know how the sound of the cicadas penetrates. So this is this principle is called Niku Isho in Japanese. Two phrases, one poem, or two poems in one. There's stillness in the first phrase, juxtaposed with the penetrating intensity of the cicada's call in the second two phrases. How can they both be true? They are both true. Now, how much haiku can be considered a Zen art has been a matter of some debate. There are plenty of haiku in both Japanese and other languages that don't display a particularly Zen-like sensibility. Haiku have been written to congratulate, to praise, to describe, to express gratitude or wit or cleverness, disappointment, resentment, but not typically to express enlightenment. Haiku tends towards understatement. Basho himself, in his only haiku that directly refers to the subject of enlightenment, actually expresses skepticism. He starts with an epigram to the haiku in which he says, "A certain wise man said to me, 'Undigested Zen and undigested Buddhism, they are hell.'" And then here's the haiku. "Inazuma ni satoranu hito no toto sayo." Someone not enlightened by lightning, how venerable. Basho had practiced Zen enough to be suspicious of sudden enlightenment. He's poking fun at someone's pretension to enlightenment, maybe even his own. Maybe he'd had a deeply moving, even life-changing experience of dropping away body and mind, emptiness. And then, a few days or weeks or months later, he realized how persistent the habit patterns of our karmic lives are. Maybe he asked himself, "Why am I still so lonely? Why can't I be content with this simple life?" He wrote haiku like that. But Basho was a serious Zen practitioner. He received lay ordination, and he lived the life of a wandering monk most of his life. He really conceived of haiku as a spiritual practice and path. He folded everything into his haiku practice: doubt, loneliness, warm companionship, absurdity, joy, many moments of fleeting beauty. And many of his disciples carried his Zen sensibility on in their work. And it continues to this day. Haiku really flourished out of a poetic tradition that was so steeped in Zen culture that the connections didn't need to be made explicit for haiku to express a Zen sensibility. The words that are used to describe haiku aesthetics convey this sensibility quite well. Perhaps the preeminent one is sabi. Have you ever heard that word, sabi? Sometimes it's combined with wabi, wabi-sabi, but that annoys me. Sabi refers to beauty that's tinged with loneliness and awareness of the transient nature of all things. And Basho wrote many haiku on loneliness. It was a central theme in his life. This wandering life, cuckoo calling deep in the forest, deepens my loneliness. Sabi also has a kind of double-layered meaning. In colloquial Japanese, sabi means rust, so it's sort of the patina of age. And sabishi means lonely in contemporary Japanese. So there's sort of a double layer there. So in haiku practice, as in Zen practice, our karmic habit patterns arise and become grist for the mill. We write haiku about them. And with this kind of clear seeing and acceptance, they're purified. We let go, even momentarily, of our constant gauging of whether this event or object or person is good or bad for us. In his later years, Basho wrote more haiku with what he called karumi, or lightness, which is kind of a of finding beauty in just in many ordinary things, with less of the intensity that he had when he was younger, more lightness. As the year draws to its close, I am still wearing my straw hat and sandals. So in haiku, we can notice and with gratitude even the smallest details of our lives. And then there's humor. There's no special word for that, for, you know, aesthetic word, but there's a lot of humor in haiku. Here's one by Issa. Flies in the temple imitating the hands of people with their malas, or juzu in Japanese. And eat and run, the wisdom of mosquitoes and fleas in the zendo. There must have been a lot of them in those days. Another word for the haiku aesthetic is wabi. Wabi is kind of the very austere beauty of rustic, worn, and aged things. It's the beauty of tea ceremony. Here's one by Ryota. Saying nothing, the guest, the host, and the white chrysanthemum. That one makes me think about the lines that we chant at mealtime during Zen retreats. May we realize the emptiness of the three wheels, giver, receiver, and gift. Ruth talked about this in her class Sunday, that there's the reader, the writer, and the poem, or the painting, or the, you know, the pot. There's the giver, the receiver, and the gift, and the emptiness of the giver, receiver, and gift is the inseparability of the giver, receiver, and the gift. And haiku are so spare that they really do recruit the reader to be kind of the co-poet and to enter into the space and fill out with our own associations and imagination and memories. Haiku typically does not analyze, interpret, explain, teach, or preach, or moralize. Although there are good exceptions to that rule too. And haiku overall is not really emotive, and certainly not sentimental for the most part. Haiku are typically not explicit about what the poet thinks or feels, simply evoking what Basho called the feeling emanating from the thing itself. So, Clark Strand, who's an American Zen priest and haiku poet and teacher of haiku, says that writing haiku requires us to unwrap ourselves. He says, as modern human beings, we spend much of our lives wrapped up inside ourselves. The way of haiku is to come unwrapped and thereby notice what lies outside of the self. Without unwrapping ourselves, it is not possible to follow nature. It is not even possible to notice nature, much less to look carefully and with heart. So I'd say it takes courage to unwrap ourselves, you know, to let go of our self-focus and love the world without reserve, to go deeper into loneliness, to accept with gratitude whatever life presents, to embrace the paradox of freedom and limitation, and to smile sadly or wryly at the ways of the world. It takes courage to make a daily practice of something so simple and mundane as sitting in silence or writing short, simple poems without hope of achievement or grandeur. just sitting for sitting's sake, as Dogen Zenji would say, just writing haiku, perhaps as an offering to give back to life something of what we have received. The way a small child might delight in picking up an object that pleases him or her and giving it to someone they love. Only you can make your haiku. Only I can make mine. But because we both have eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind, your words resonate in me and mine resonate in you. And your words and my words will resonate differently in each other person who hears them. I think haiku, perhaps more than any other kind of poetry, has always functioned as Zen words do, as the finger pointing to the moon. You heard that expression? Yeah. So, I'm going to pause here.